So today we continue our discussion this month of wealth. And we begin. So these Sunday sits, for those who are familiar with these, they began as family sits. And so we had this tradition of reading a children's story right about now during these sits. And we've continued it even as we've moved to Zoom. And sometimes we have kids who are with us, and sometimes we don't. I know my own son used to join. He stopped doing that these days. But I know that last week there were a few. In any case, we continue by starting this with a children's story on the topic of wealth. I picked one out. I'm going to read it aloud, so I don't have the book to show you photos. This one is called The Magic Pot. Once upon a time, there lived a kind and diligent farmer. The farmer bought a piece of land from a rich old man who lived next door, hoping to farm it. But there were so many stones and rocks in the field. The farmer had to go to the field early each morning and worked very hard to pick out the stones and rocks. One hot afternoon, while the farmer was digging in the ground, he struck something hard. "What is this?" he wondered. "There's something in the ground." He continued to dig and found a huge pot. "Maybe I can use this to store some rice," he thought. So the farmer put some rice in it, but something strange happened when he looked in the pot the next morning. He couldn't believe his eyes. The pot was overflowing with rice. He turned to his wife and said, "Look, this is a magic pot. What luck!" "What luck indeed," she said. The farmer and his wife put a piece of bread for dinner inside the pot, and after a few moments, he found two pieces of bread. It really was magical. After that, the farmer put many things in the pot: copper coins, rice, gold. With that pot, the farmer became a rich man. Now, the rich man who lived next door heard the news about the magic pot, and he came over to the farmer's house to see it. Then he asked the farmer to return the pot to him. "Why should I give you the pot?" the farmer asked. "I sold you the field, so the pot is mine," replied the rich neighbor. Farmer and his neighbor argued for a while before deciding to take the matter to the king. The king, upon hearing the story, became very interested in the pot. "This pot seems quite valuable," he said. "I believe it should be in the king's treasury." And so the king ordered his soldiers to bring the magic pot to him. They stormed into the house of the farmer and confiscated the pot and brought it to the king. After the pot was placed in front of him, the king remarked, "Let me see what's inside the pot that makes it so magical. Once I find what it is, I will become 100 times as powerful." So the king peered over into the pot and looked into it. And as he did, he lost his balance and fell into the pot. He hit his head on the edge and fell unconscious. When he woke up, he saw that there were hundreds of kings identical to him in the room. They all fought each other to get to the throne, and soon there was a civil war. The pot was forgotten in the turmoil. The news of all of this reached the farmer and his wife. "Should we get the pot back now?" the farmer asked his wife. "The king was foolish, and his greed has come back to harm him," said his wife. "It is not safe to keep the pot anymore. We have enough money and the riches to take care of ourselves and our children now. Let's leave the pot with the king." And so they did. There you have it. Craving, greed, suffering, scarcity, abundance. It's all in there. We can all go now. I wanted to begin. That we'll get to the story and its meaning, I think, in a circuitous route. And I wanted to begin actually with a little bit of economic history. One of my things is I'm an economist, and so I thought that we could start with this. This is about the origin of money. So money was not actually created as a way to store wealth. It was created as a way to make trading easier. You know, if you lived in a community and you didn't want to wholly fend for yourself, you know, you specialized in doing your one thing. Maybe you raised the chickens and you gave everyone the eggs, and you depended on everyone else for the rest of your needs. And then you traded a little bit of what you had for what they had. And money came about as a way to just make this trading easier. You know, if you wanted furniture and the furniture person didn't quite need any more eggs, you gave her money instead, and then she could return the money to you as a sort of IOU. You were giving the money. She could return it to you and collect the eggs when she actually needed them. Money also made three-way deals a little bit more easy. Like, suppose you wanted what person A had and they wanted what person B had, and person B wanted your eggs. Then, you know, you could just give each other money instead of having to coordinate, you know, all of those interactions to make sure that, you know, everyone who wanted what from whom all the time knew those other people. Anyway, the point is, it started out with this simple and elegant idea. And you only really accumulated money when you needed something bigger. Like if I needed a bed from the carpenter and I didn't have enough eggs this week, you know, to make up for the whole bed's value, I could save up the money I was getting from selling my eggs slowly and then finally buy that bed. But these days, well, it's different, right? We all must accumulate money, and we have different levels of access to money. And this leads to everything, right? Our perceptions of inequality, of social status, craving and clinging, forming identities around wealth. You know, all this suffering associated with money that we've created, constructed, and yet it comes from such a simple, elegant intention. Last week, Tuere talked about the Buddha's teachings and on money. And, you know, by the Buddha's time, money was clearly associated with social status and with caste and with all the complex layers of meaning we were just talking about. And as to where I talked about it last week, the Buddha nonetheless said accumulating money was not a shameful thing and rather tied to being able to enjoy life. That was the Buddha's perspective. And, you know, when we hear that, that can bring up a lot of tension for us as we encounter all of the complications with money, right? I think that teaching comes from a fundamentally clear view of money and wealth that strips away a lot of that complexity that we've created around it. To give an analogy, if you felt the sun on your face and you enjoyed it, you wouldn't feel bad turning to a friend and saying that you had really enjoyed that sunshine on your face. You know, you could express that pleasure and have them take pleasure in your enjoyment of that sunshine in a simple way. Imagine if we could talk about enjoying something we spent on, you know, maybe taking a luxury with our money and having it be the same way, where a friend just enjoys in a simple way what we were able to appreciate. The way we could talk about sunshine hitting our faces. When we think about things like that, that kind of inquiry gets to, you know, it points to some of the things that we have challenges with about money. The reasons why it's not quite the same to talk about that. Imagine another scenario. Suppose you talked about the amount of rain that fell on your vegetable garden last spring. And you were able to talk about the way you earned money last year in the same way. You know, We treat the rain as something impersonal, something that just happened to you, right? And so it doesn't feel bad to say, oh, you know, I got plenty of rain on my vegetable garden last year. It doesn't feel like a boast. Or if we didn't get a lot of rain on our vegetable garden, it doesn't feel like a source of deep shame. It's not personal. But if we were thinking about talking about the amount of money we earned, it's not quite the same. We don't think of money that way as just a circumstance. We make it personal. Even when the circumstances we were born into, the things that have happened to us, you know, they're all at some level impersonal. There are many impersonal aspects to the amount of wealth that we have. But we all know the complications that can arise from doing something like that. We worry that we'll be perceived as bragging about our social status, of creating distance with the people we're speaking to. And others may really think that's what we're trying to do. There are all these problems. So I think the Buddha was pointing to the possibility of having that clear and uncomplicated relationship with sources of pleasure, including wealth, right, as a source of pleasure. And the possibility that we can think of varying degrees of wealth as simply being the causes and conditions to which we're responding. So I think it's valuable to have that in our minds as an ideal to which we might strive, just having this uncomplicated relationship with money. But I also want to say that, you know, I believe in starting our practice where we are currently. And for most of us, we're not close to that endpoint. It's something we can keep in mind as like, wouldn't it be nice? But I want to spend the rest of our time thinking about the things that get in the way. We all have mindsets towards money that can be quite subtle. And before I go into a lot of detailed examples, I think the most important thing here is your own inquiry into these questions, right? What gets in the way of that simple and clear relationship with money? Here, I'm just mentioning some things that can maybe spark that inquiry or drive it in specific directions. And, you know, if you feel a strong reaction to anything that I say during this, my invitation is to ask why, not because you're wrong, but because in that inquiry comes this wisdom, right? So I'm just mentioning some things. The inquiry you do on your own, I feel like, is the most valuable thing. Many people have what we could describe as a scarcity mentality. Now, what that really means is that we see wealth as a zero-sum game. You know, if someone else has a lot of money, you know, a lavish lifestyle, the works, we not only crave that thing, there's this feeling like it's been taken from us. It's been taken from the rest of the world. And if we ourselves have a lot of money, we have this feeling like we've taken it away from everyone else, right? We feel guilty about it. Even that perspective from having a lot of money, the guilt we feel, that's also scarcity mentality, right? And the opposite of that is an abundance mentality. Right? The feeling that we will always have what we need, and that by partaking of what we need from the world, we don't need to feel guilty. We don't need to feel selfish. That's our existence, right? When we have a sense of abundance, we can actually be more generous, not less. And I think there are two different reasons for that. First, when we aren't acting from guilt, we can see more truly what the needs of others really are. And I'll give some examples of that in a moment. The second is we have less fear associated with giving away what we have. Because that abundance mentality, that scarcity mentality cuts both ways. We fear losing what we have. So Wes Nisker is... he's a Dharma teacher at Spirit Rock, and he once asked Gary Snyder, who's a, you know, he's an environmentalist and a poet, and he won a Pulitzer Prize for his work. And he asked him during an interview for what advice he'd give to environmentalists. And Gary's advice was, don't save the world because you feel guilty. Guilt anger, and fear are part of the problem. If you want to save the world, save it because you love it. I used to have, on a personal note, this social anxiety. Whenever I went to dinner at a friend's place, you know, as soon as I got the invitation to come, I'd start thinking, oh boy, you know, I'd get to the dinner and I didn't feel comfortable, you know, just sitting back, sipping a glass of wine maybe, and enjoying the fact that they had cooked this meal for me. Maybe I'd have to be sitting at a table watching them, like, you know, do the final prep work. And I couldn't just sit there and enjoy the moment. Like I had to, you know, I would ask first, like, oh, can I help you with the chopping? Can I help you with this and that? And, you know, I wouldn't even take no for an answer, you know? And finally people would be like, okay, fine, do this one thing, Arv, you know, do this. Okay, you can chop this vegetable. You kind of give me a task to humor me, and, you know, because they could see that I really needed to do this thing. And, you know, at the end of the dinner, you know, I would still have this anxiety. I'd be walking back thinking to myself, you know, okay, I have to invite them for dinner now, and I have to do it relatively soon so that they don't feel like it's an affront. You know, and the whole experience was kind of fraught. And the paradox here is, you know, I've slowly been able to let go of this and just, you know, sit back and enjoy someone pampering me if they've invited me for dinner. And, you know, the paradox is when I finally let go and enjoy, you know, the environment gets warmer, the conversation gets more meaningful, I can actually pay attention to what people are saying, and I'm increasing their enjoyment of the evening when I do that, right? Like, no one wants a guest who's just sitting there being anxious about, you know, their, you know, your happiness the whole time. You want them to enjoy it. That's why you're doing it, right? And so they enjoy it more. And, you know, sometimes it's actually led me to listen to a friend and actually talk them through something they're going through. Like, maybe that was kind of there behind their reason for inviting me. And then I've actually done them a service. I've actually been able to sit and listen. And so by letting go of this scarcity mentality, in this case, you know, this is the guilt for taking up resources, you know, we become clearer. You know, we can see more deeply the real needs. We can be more generous in the right ways. And the reason is we're really letting go of this idea that it's a zero-sum game, you know. It not only means, you know, when we have that feeling, it not only means that I should feel guilty for having more. It also means when I'm giving it away, I'm not risking. I'm risking having not enough for myself, right? So in my research, I'm an economist. I looked at this. I'm a behavioral economist, and this research on happiness took a revolutionary turn about 10 years ago. I'll go briefly into this. It was a group of psychologists and economists who got together, and they went to different parts of the world, different societies, some well-off, some not, many different cultures, and they tried to probe whether people were happy and what conditions led to their happiness. And so they found some things that were very clear about wealth, that when our basic needs are not taken care of, like if we don't have food security, when we're not sure whether we're going to get our next meals, when we're not secure in our housing, when we don't have our basic healthcare needs met, you know, when people were at that level, giving them more money or earning more money led to increased happiness. It really did. There was a tie between money and happiness at that level. But beyond that basic level, you know, money wasn't, it had a much more complicated relationship with happiness. One of the strongest findings that they found in this research was that it really depended on the people in your environment. If you were the poorest person in Beverly Hills, you were deeply unhappy with your money situation. Money was making you unhappy. And if you were the wealthiest person in a rural community that was resource poor in a developing country, you felt great about your money situation. And, you know, when I say this, I'm sure a lot of you can feel that, right? That makes sense to us. We can feel the truth of those words. And yet, you know, you know, what it's really saying is, you know, it is something that we've forgotten, I think. You know, our whole lives we've been conditioned to strive for money, for more money. And in the back of our minds, it's because we associate that with an increased happiness. And what this is saying is that, you know, beyond that certain level, it's totally wrongheaded if what you're interested in from money is happiness, right? It's not going to get you there. We all know this at some level. We just lose access to this truth. And I think a lot of the pain we feel around inequality could be loosened if we just had access to this. You know, in to go on with international development, you know, my job used to be to study programs for people in developing countries and tell the people who funded them whether those programs were working or not. And, you know, we would measure whether those programs were working in a bunch of ways. You know, when we built an irrigation system, you know, did their crop yields go up? Did they earn more, et cetera? And, you know, sometimes these programs, they did real good. You know, there was real poverty in these areas sometimes, you know, and the work was great. It did really good things. It both increased their wealth and their happiness. But often we would go into communities that were sort of, you know, by the numbers poor, but were actually quite functional. And we would, what we were doing is increasing this. We were introducing a scarcity mentality, or we were increasing the existing scarcity mentality. We'd make some pieces of land worth much more than others with the programs to, you know, to increase farming output. And, you know, they would inadvertently create competition for that land, and some would win those competitions and some would lose. There's more grasping. And, you know, we'd go out with our surveys at the end, sure, and we'd find that the community made more money after we put the irrigation system in. You know, so check mark, you know, thumbs up to the program is what would come back in the report. But when I would go there and you know, sort of be on the ground, there were times when I was not sure if we were making people happier. So that's a lot about scarcity mentality. The thing I'm trying to get across is that these feelings, this, you know, this wanting what someone else has, and this guilt for having what others don't, there are good reasons to think that these are things we've constructed in our minds, and that disassembling them would be healthy, not just for ourselves, but for our society. By disassembling them, we can alleviate some of this pain around inequality. And I think we can also align our actions around the types of generosity that really matter. We can listen more deeply to what people really want. I want to talk for a moment also about scarcity and identity. You know, scarcity mentality can be really deeply ingrained within us. And, you know, the idea of being without money can create a very painful sort of fear. And I think that the reason for this fear, the reason for this insecurity, is that we've become identified with the lack, with the fear of not having enough. Last week, Tuere told a story about her friend, right, who always complained about not having enough money to the extent that Tuere thought she was, you know, she was destitute and looked up all these social programs. And it turned out that the friend had what Tuere thought was quite a lot of money. It was really a perception, a fear of, you know, an identity of lack. We may inherit these identities, but they also arise through some of the processes we discussed last year when we talked about dependent origination, right? Not to go into too much detail there, but craving money turns into clinging. Clinging arises from this, a deeper identification, right? And we're not just clinging when we cling to money, we're clinging to the craving itself, right? From that clinging, becoming, we become these things, these beings that are identified with the need for money. And so part of that fear that we're talking about, it really comes from a threat to our identity. when we think about losing the money we have, it's like it's taking away an identity from us and having our sense of self drop out. So what do we do about all this? You know, as we noted when we talked about craving, clinging, and becoming last year, it can be really hard to get under our identities, right? So we can begin by just softening the edges of them. Just touching perhaps the feeling of fear. You know, you make an inquiry. You know, what's my relationship to money? What would I be without this identification with money? What would I be without this money that I have? And, you know, as we're mindful of what comes up during the inquiry, we can just touch on the feeling of fear, if that's what arises, and hold it with some compassion, some curiosity. Soften into it. And as to where I mentioned last week, you don't go all in at once, right? You don't go to the hardest thing. You start, you know, with a gentler touching of that fear, and you maintain some patience with the process. It doesn't work all at once. It slowly settles into us. Okay. It's nearly 11, so we're going to go into our breakout room soon. I'd like to, for these breakouts, so for those who are new today, in this next section, I'm going to divide everyone into breakout rooms where we can discuss some of the topics that came up today. And, you know, anything that's arisen from this is fair game for discussion. But if you need a prompt, one that I would invite is something that we touched upon earlier. It's this inquiry. Why is it so hard to talk about the money we earn? Why is it easier to talk about something like the rainfall that fell on our garden? I want to mention also, you know, you don't have to take up that inquiry. And if you do, this is not about talking about how much money we earn. I want to avoid that subject coming up. It can be a source of great discomfort. We're asking, why is it hard? Why is this something difficult, if not for us, but in general for people? All right. We have a few minutes now at the end before we go into some announcements and updates that Jerry will lead. We have a few minutes. If anyone has any comments, either about what they discussed or what went on in the talk, any questions?
Yeah, this is Carol. I'm Amy's mom. I always seem to be identified as that. But I think there's one thing that everyone in our group identified with your social anxiety. So basically the point that I would want to make that I took away was that it feels like we need to in order to receive abundance, we have to earn it. And so that's not really abundance, that's actually scarcity. So there's a kind of a prerequisite that we have to value before we can accept abundance.
We have to, I missed one word you said, we have to something value before we can accept abundance.
We have to actually have value. We have to contribute value in order to get the abundance. We can't just receive it.
Yeah. I think that's part of scarcity mentality. You know, it's this, there's something underneath that almost, you know, if we take that to its most basic level, there is a sense that we need to earn our existence in the world. Mm-hmm. We need to earn our place. We need to earn the love of others before we can receive it. And that, I think, gets to the very heart of what causes pain in this scarcity mentality. Like, so I would just leave with the inquiry, what if we didn't have to earn it? What if we deserved it? Yeah. Thank you. Thank you. I think that really got to the heart of this.
Hey, Arv.
Hey, Dane.
Hi. You mentioned not helping out of fear or guilt was what one teacher had said. And I understand that inquiry to like examine where we are helping from. But what would the inquiry be to transition to helping out of, you know, love or whatever else there is out there? What would that look like?
Yeah, yeah. I think there's a large degree to which it comes naturally when we have an abundance mindset. You know, when we feel like we have what we need and giving doesn't reduce what we need. Well, you know, our possessions. We're not encountering fear of lack when we give. Then two things happen. One is it is easier to give. It becomes naturally easier. The other is, you know, there, we can see the path to giving more clearly because we're not clouded by this idea of guilt. You know, so in a way, I would say that, you know, that path is going to be an individual one. There's not a prescribed thing I can say that this is how you do it. But when you're aligned internally, when you're coming at this with the right internal sense, you know, that abundant sense, you will understand what it is you need to do to give to yourself, to give to the world. There's a wonderful poem about this. I don't know. I don't think we have time to read a poem, do we? Maybe I'll read a poem. I'm going to read a poem really quickly.
Yeah, we do have time.
Do we have time? Okay. Yeah. I love this poem. And it so talks about, okay, here we go. I'm pulling it up. This is a poem. It's called Clearing by Martha Postlethwaite. Martha writes, "Do not try to save the whole world or do anything grandiose. Instead, create a clearing in the dense forest of your life and wait there patiently until the song that is your life falls into your own cupped hands and you recognize and greet it. Only then will you know how to give yourself to this world so worthy of rescue."
Nice art.
It's beautiful, isn't it? Martha has, her background is as a pastor and not a poet. And she wrote that on a retreat. Yeah, I think it really gets to the heart of this too. You know, it's in that contemplation. Once we've created the clearing, that we learn what to do next.
Thank you, Arf.
Thank you, Dan. That was a great question.
So, Arf, I have a question because you talked in, your talk was so good and you were telling about the research when people didn't have their basic food, housing, and healthcare needs taken care of. And to some extent, the conversation we're having seems to be directed towards people whose basic needs are met. And none of us know each other's circumstances, but what about when the fear is a real one? It's, you know, that you don't know whether, you know, you're going to get your next unemployment check or whether you're going to, you know, your landlord's going to kick you out when the moratorium is done. Or I just wonder what the practice has to say that way as well.
Yeah.
Speak to that.
I'm really glad you bring that up because it's one thing that, you know, I didn't spend a lot of time talking about. Yeah, there is a such thing as real need, isn't there? There is real food insecurity, real need for housing, real need for healthcare. None of this is to say that those needs aren't real. At below a certain level in that happiness research, you know, having these things made people happy. It helped them lead fulfilling lives. And you're right, most of what I'm talking about are these ways in which our own perceptions can cloud us into applying that feeling, even when it's not applicable, right? To ourselves, for example, our own senses of scarcity, if we are people who do have enough. And to others, thinking they may be in need when they don't. When someone actually is in need, yeah, I think we all can feel that and sense that, right? By clearing this pathway to what is true generosity, you know, we're also connecting with the humanity of the people around us in an unclouded way. And if we connect to the humanity of people in our society and we see that real need or we learn about that real need, I think the natural thing to do is to try our best to meet it, right? And if we do that from a place of abundance, then we're less likely to sort of step past that person or ignore that person thinking, oh, well, someone else will take care of them. Or, well, it's not my specific responsibility to take care of them. That place of abundance is also a place of connection, right? We can understand our own responsibility. And I think that for those of us who do feel that we have the abundance, that you know, we have what we need, you know, for me personally, just to speak personally, Suze, you can cultivate this notion that wealth or money flows through you, right? That it's not necessarily yours. When you earn it, what you're really earning is a choice for where to allocate it. You can choose to put that in your own pocket, and sometimes that's wise, in your families, in your friends, or you can choose to spend that on the people in your society, in your community, who need it. And when we feel that deep connection, that unclouded connection that's not clouded by guilt or scarcity, yeah, I think we can understand where those needs are, and we can choose to allocate it as it needs to go in a more free and giving way. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you, Arv. I need to jump in if I, you know, I guess that's staying on schedule. I really appreciate those closing comments in that poem. Glad you took the time for that. Yeah, I appreciate gathering here today too. And, before we go here, just want to do a couple of things. First of all, remind folks about, that Arv's his teachings, all the work that he put into preparing for this talk, and all the teachers in this tradition. So all the teachings are offered out of generosity, this, out of a caring, of an interest, and sharing the Dharma, and hopefully it's helpful for you. And I've always appreciated how we can respond in kind, not in so much in kind, but we can respond with our own generosity using Dana. And so Dana is, you know, just a freely given offering in appreciation, and gratitude, and generosity to help support the teachings that have been going on for 2,600 years. So thanks, everybody, for being here. Why don't we end with a sit? Now that I talked really fast, I feel all energized with all those words. So I always like to come to stillness. So one last time, or maybe not last time, but right now, allowing ourselves to be still, knowing we're here, connecting with our bodies, our breath, recognizing the busyness of our minds, allowing that to settle, and having a sense of gratitude that in this whole COVID world, we're able to connect and find support with the Dharma. And from this, Maybe we can share the benefits that we have from the Dharma, share this wealth of the Dharma with all beings. So that as we act and speak and interact with our community, with our friends, with the rest of the world, act with a wish that all beings can be at peace, they can find enough to put a roof over their heads and have a basic level of comfort at least, and find a way to be happy and at ease amongst all living beings. May we all live in peace.